So I can't see you, but maybe I can feel your presence. And that's how it is with the gravitational wave observation. Until this observation that was found made last September, the only way we learned about the rest of the cosmos, besides the Earth that we can touch and see and feel, was through electromagnetic radiation and a few other things, cosmic rays and neutrinos. But for the rest, it was just looking and seeing. But now, because of the gravitational waves, we can, in a sense, feel the cosmos. We can experience motion, space-time distortions. So that's the basic idea here. So we've got sort of three theories of gravity in the past and up to the present. So Aristotle's theory of gravity, things fall because that's where they belong, their natural place. Newton's theory of gravity, things attract one another by virtue of having mass. Newton's law of universal gravitation. Einstein's theory of gravity is general relativity, which is summarized nicely by John Arthur Wheeler by saying that matter tells space-time how to occur, and space-time tells matter how to move. So there's a little graphic there of the Earth with the moon orbiting around the Earth. So why does the moon orbit around the Earth according to Einstein's theory of general relativity? Well, because the Earth creates a curve, a distorted space-time in its vicinity, and then the moon travels in the shortest path, the geodesic, around the Earth. So there's this sort of analogy that you've all seen about a bowling ball sitting in a trampoline and a marble being tossed around that bowling ball, will experience that bowling ball through the space, through the distortion of the trampoline. That's the theory of general relativity, our modern theory of gravity. And so already early on, it was realized that gravitational waves would be emitted when there were masses moving around one another. So gravitational waves were predicted early on in the development of general relativity. Now there's a few ASA connections that we have with gravitational waves. I just want to bring these to your attention. So in fact, what happened was that Steve asked me to give this talk, and I punted it first to George Murphy. George wasn't coming. I punted second to Robert Mann. Robert Mann wasn't coming. I punched next to Joan Centrella, she wasn't coming. And I punched next to anybody in LIGO who is a member of ASA, and we didn't hear from any of them. So I'm here sort of by default, partly because Steve, and I have this ongoing thing of getting each other to do important tasks. So George Murphy has a paper on gravitational waves. He published this in 1978, Gravitons from a Spinning Rod in the Australian Journal of Physics. And one of his observations in that paper was that we can't use the general theory of relativity's classical approach when we have something that's doesn't have very much mass, and you work out the mass limit. So if something is much greater than over about 4,000 kilograms, so if you have a spinning rod, much heavier than 4 tons, then that spinning rod will emit gravitational waves. But if it's less than about that amount, it will not emit waves, but it will emit individual gravitons in a similar way as how atoms emit individual photons by electrons losing energy and going to one energy level lower. So that's George Murphy. He's also got some other reflections on gravitational waves, which I'll refer to later. In 2007, we had Joan Centrella speaking at the ASA CIS conference in Edinburgh. Just before she spoke, she had won the NASA Exceptional Scientific Achievement Medal for a simulation of gravitational wave signals from merging black holes. And as it turns out, it's the merging black holes that we first saw in this past September, and the calculations that were done by Joan Centrella and others, and because of the nature of the confirmation of how the signals that we received matched those calculations, we knew that it was black holes that were merging, not something else. So she gave a plenary in August 2007. She was then the head of the Gravitational Astrophysics Laboratory, and now she's the deputy director of NASA. So I don't know how many of you were at that 2007 meeting. Just raise your hand if you were. So there's some really neat ASA connections here. And there's another connection. I'm speaking here, and it turns out that one of my first papers has three of the same words as the paper published on the gravitational wave discovery. So black hole mergers. I guess the word "as" also there, but my paper had nothing to do with how the gravitational waves were being emitted. So gravitational waves are first indirectly detected back after a discovery of a pulsar in 1974, the 1913 plus 16 pulsar. This is a case where there's a one neutron star and another neutron star, which is the pulsar, orbiting one another, and there's about a 7 3/4 hour period of revolution. And it was noticed that the period decreased over time. So we've got a graph there over about a 30-year period of the shift of the periods from 7 3/4 hours down. It's down now 40 seconds less than it was then. And the reason for that is that these two masses that are orbiting one another are giving off energy. They're emitting gravitational waves. They're losing energy and therefore speeding up. It might seem sort of counterintuitive, but they speed up when they lose energy. But that's what happens in planetary orbits. When you lose energy, you come closer to each other, and then you're going faster. So you're gaining kinetic energy, but you're losing twice as much potential energy by the virial theorem. And so this observation matched with general relativity predictions within the 1%. And so this was a really strong confirmation of the existence of gravitational waves. But it's indirect, because we didn't measure the waves themselves. We measured the loss of energy that wave emission represented. And so up on the top right, there's Paulson Taylor, who won the 1993 Nobel Prize for that discovery and for the following observations of the shift of the period. So here's a brief primer on what happens in our current observations of the gravitational wave. So you've probably all heard of the Michelson-Morley experiment, where you have two perpendicular beams that are being brought back together. So here is a laser source that comes along to a beam splitter. Half of the beam travels up to this mirror and back through to here. The other half of the beam continues and reflects back over to here. And then you have those two beams that are combined together. So as those two beams combine, there's interference between the two. And so what is done in the LIGO experiment is that we originally started out so that there's cancellation. There's exact cancellation of the light from the two different beams, and so the detector down over here, the detector sees nothing. So if the distances here and here are exactly equal, as indicated sort of by this figure as well, that this distance and that this distance, this circle has not been distorted. So when the circle is not distorted, then the distances are equal and you get exact cancellation. I'll play the video now. I hope it'll work. It's on my computer, so it's working. So here's a video of the motion. If space-time gets distorted, so that this beam lengthens or contracts in comparison to this beam, then there's a distortion of space and time, and then the photodetector starts to show non-zero results. And so there's always a little bit of noise in the signal, but if the signal is significant, then there'd be a clear indication that there's a variation in the length of one beam relative to the other. And this is the basic physics of what the detection is. So this is a bit of information about the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO. So the ideas on using interferometry started about 40 years ago, and about 24 years ago they started actually working on and developing the project, LIGO. And they started to be doing runs in the year 2002. For the first 8 years, the observations were nothing. We'd seen nothing. It's kind of disappointing, I suppose, to keep on publishing a null result. I don't know how many papers were produced during the null result period, but a lot of development and instrumentation was being done. So here's a picture of one of the LIGO sites. This is the Hanford LIGO site. This is a 4 kilometer long arm, and another 4 kilometer long arm going over there with mirrors, just like in the figure over here. So there's the schematic, and here's the picture of what's happening in reality. So there's a lot of technology involved in terms of maintaining high vacuums and very good mirrors, and you can ask about that in the Q&A, but I know a few things about that. So the project has two basic sites, one in Hanford and one in Louisiana. And you can see, I guess, these arms indicate the orientations. This is how the arms are oriented in Hanford and in Louisiana. They're oriented in that direction. So there's expected to be differences in what they're each receiving. So the idea is that the gravitational wave would come along and distort the space in one direction relative to the other, so there would be a variation in strain, and the difference in length would result in a non-zero reading on the interferometer as the wave passes by. So they overhauled the instrument for 5 years, from 2010 to 2015, and within a few days of turning it on in September, they saw something. So, bingo. So here's a little picture. A cartoon appeared, thanks to Lauren Harshman for pointing this cartoon out to me last night, so I included it from the New Yorker. Maybe some of you watched the press conference where this discovery was announced, and these are two birds sitting there, and the bird, one bird sits there. Was that you I heard just now, or was it two black holes colliding? And the reason for that is that the sound that the gravitational waves produced was called a chirp, and it sounded like a chirp. Unfortunately, I didn't play the chirp here for you. I don't even know how to plug the thing into audio, but there is a chirp that we could hear, and I'll show the chirp visually. I'll just make a few comments about the paper as well. So, Physical Review Letters is probably the top physics journal, and here's the abstract, and you notice the publication. Date, 11th of February. My laser pointer, yes. There it is. 11th of February, 2016, published. So the observation happened on September the 14th. There were rumors floating around in October that maybe they'd seen something. This was all kept very quiet. Nothing was published for a long time. They spent 4 months writing the paper. Submitted it to the journal on the 21st of January, and it was published 3 weeks later after a pretty intense and rapid peer review because of the importance of the result. One of the things that I find really interesting about this paper is that it is quite readable by people, I think, outside of the field. I'm not in the field of gravitational waves. Some of you maybe are closer to the field than I am, but some of you are in biology or chemistry or math or philosophy, and you can read this paper yourself. There are parts of it that are kind of technical, but most of it is quite accessible. So there's a few key features of the observation that are mentioned here. First of all, the gravitational wave strain. So one part in 10 to the 21 was what was noticed. That is, the one arm got longer than the other arm by one part in 10 to the 21. So that's less than the diameter of a nucleon, like neutron or proton. So that's a very, very tiny shift, but it's a very clear shift. This was studied really closely and carefully, and in comparison with the predictions of what would happen when black holes would collide, and it was found that the observation of the gravitational wave is such that we've been able to find that the two objects that collided were very large black holes, 36 times the mass of the sun. So 36 times the mass of the sun for one of them, and 29 times the mass of the sun for the other one, all with the uncertainties right there in the abstract. And the resulting black hole had a mass of 62, and that means that three solar masses were emitted as gravitational waves. It was also known how far away this is, 410 megaparsecs, which is about, well, I've got it on a slide later on, I forget how many billion light years away that is. So here's the basic observation. Let's just go back to the fact that there are two detectors. So one a detector over here, one over here. And one of the important things to do is to note that when you've got a local effect versus an effect that is truly, in a sense, global. So if there's some truck driving past LIGO in Hanford, obviously that would not show up in Louisiana. And so whatever signal occurs in one, if it doesn't occur in the other, it isn't a real signal. So we're always comparing the two signals, as well as trying to vibrate, to do a lot of vibration isolation to make sure you're not picking up local signals. And so the distance between those two detectors is 10 milliseconds of light travel time. So it turns out that there was a very strong signal pickup in one location, and then 7 milliseconds later, the very same signal was picked up at the other one. Not the very same exactly, but slightly different because of the different orientations of the lakes. And so that different orientations, those different orientations gave information about, gave more clear indication of the location. So you can see, for example, if the time difference was 10 milliseconds between the two signals, that would mean that the source was lined up along the line connecting H1 and L1. If the time difference was zero, then that would indicate that the source would be in a plane perpendicular to the bisector of those two. And so 7 milliseconds difference versus 10 versus zero gives you an indication of what part of the sky we're dealing with. And so just from the 7 versus the 10, you can say that's where the signal must have come from, some direction like that. And then using other information connecting from the orientations and the slight differences between the signals gives us more information on the location. So here are the two signals. On the left, it's Hanford, and on the right, Livingston, Louisiana. And those two signals are superimposed on one another with a little shift, so to show how they line up nicely. And so there's, you can see the sort of background wiggle that's always occurring, and then suddenly big stuff, and then background wiggle, and it goes away. And you can see the short time frame we're dealing with here, so 0.3 to 0.45 seconds. And so this duration is just 0.15 of a second, so 1/6 of a second is this time period right here. That's the time where the observation was above the signal-to-noise ratio, and they were able to track it back further and match that to the numerical relativity calculations by Jones and Trella et al. So this down here is the difference between the observed wave and the predicted wave coming from the numerical relativity calculations. And there's a nice picture here which shows the frequency of the signal. So the frequency is increasing as the signal comes by. It's a low frequency and then it becomes a higher frequency. And this plot shows the frequency and the intensity. And when this is played in the visual, in the auditory realm, then we hear a little chirp. And that's the chirp that those two birds were referring to, I suppose, when they were in the cartoon. So I'm just going to highlight again the work of Joan Centrella, who spoke at the 2007 ASA meeting. It was her numerical relativity breakthroughs that were cited in this paper as well, in the February 11 paper. The 2006 paper that Joan Centrella wrote, which resulted in her getting that prize I mentioned a little while ago. So here's a little graphic that shows something about what the characteristics are of what's happening in the final stages. And so what we have is two black holes, both very heavy, and they're both rotating around one another, and they're spiraling in toward each other. And as they spiral in toward each other, we expect to see this sort of a thing. And as they merge, we see this rapid increase in frequency. And then after the merger has occurred of those two black holes, we get this what's called a ring down. And after that, it's just a single black hole, which is no longer emitting gravitational radiation. So the gravitational radiation intensity rises and becomes more rapid, and then rings down, and that's it. A few neat things to see on the graph over here. The speed of the black holes and the distance between the two black holes. So in terms of the radius of the sun, how far apart are they? Well, they began like 5 solar radii apart in this short period of time, and they ended up being 1.5 solar radii apart and then merged. And how fast are they going? Well, in this period of time, they started off going about a third of the speed of light, and they spiraled inward, and over the course of 0.15 seconds, they doubled in their speed, roughly, like from about a third of the speed of light to almost 60% of the speed of light. That's a really huge tangential acceleration. which is explaining partly why there's so much radiation being emitted. You don't see these sort of measurements typically, right? Those sorts of speeds and that sort of rapid increase. These are clearly relativistic speeds. You can't do the calculation just using Newtonian physics. So I mentioned some of the details already. The speeds are greater than half the speed of light. The masses of the two black holes, I'm not putting up on the screen here the uncertainties, but they do have the uncertainties that I mentioned earlier. 36 solar masses plus 29 solar masses equals 62 solar masses plus 3. Right? So the plus 3, the 3 solar masses that are missing, are the amount of energy that is being given off during that merger. So the merger happens over this very short time. Like, I guess you would, I don't know what you would call the merger, it's right in here. And during that time, we are losing, within a very short time, 3 times the mass of the sun. And that mass is turned into energy, which is radiated out by the gravitational waves, and which traveled these billions of years, and we finally picked them up today. And so the peak luminosity of how bright, how much energy is being given off by this system, 200 solar masses per second is the luminosity, which is, I've heard, is greater than the total luminosity of the whole universe otherwise. So the brightness of all the stars put together is less than the brightness of that one event of the merger of those two black holes. A few points about, as I watched the press release, some really interesting features of science were demonstrated. And I really encourage you to go on YouTube if you haven't seen the video of the press conference. The press conference shows all these features. It shows how science is a field driven by curiosity. People were really, really wondering, can we detect these gravitational waves? Are they real? It shows the nature of collaboration. I don't know how many authors, I was going to start counting them, but it's something like about 600 or 700 authors were involved in the paper, and the paper has a list covering 3 pages listing all the names of all the authors, of all of the contributors, 3 of whom have deceased since the beginning of the project, but who are still mentioned posthumously. And this is the nature of an international collaboration. And when people think about science, I think the public perception is often a single solitary figure leaning over a lab bench. But really, the reality is all this huge collaboration, and Roger talked about that this morning as well, the groups that were involved in all these things. The excitement, how excited people were when they saw this, and it showed up also in Roger's presentation, just seeing that the thing landed, it worked, people were cheering, right? So the press conference, this is now 5 months after the discovery, the press conference, the people were still bubbling over with excitement. They were just so excited and ready and eager to share their observations with the world. Also, the way that they showed and used caution. So again, the observation, from observation to submission of the paper was about 4 months. And so they did not have a press conference announcing the result before it was published. So in fact, during the press conference, it was mentioned that the paper has just now been published. So that's, at that point, the APS servers all crashed. That means I have 1 minute left? Okay. So other features of science were demonstrated. George Murphy has some really neat reflections in a little blog post. The Bible presents a picture of a creation intended from the beginning to change. God did not create the world in time, but with time, as Augustine said. It was not static perfection, but a cosmos directed toward a goal, the great Sabbath, the kingdom of God, and the union of all things in Christ. George Murphy, if he were here, would say these sort of things, I suppose. Our human reason is in some basic way in accord with the reason that pervades the universe. Christians can say that is because our human reason is in accord with the logos, the reason or word through whom all things were made. In one way, the prediction of gravitational waves, like the successes of other scientific theories, does carry the message that in the beginning was the word. Just a few remarks about things afterwards. So a second merger was observed already. Interestingly, the next merger was observed between the detection of the first one and the publication of the second one. The publication of the first one. So before they published the first result, they already had second observation, but they didn't trumpet that until it also went through peer review and was published in June. Future prospects, you know, we expect to see lots and lots and lots of black hole mergers. We've seen two so far. There's a plan for increasing the sensitivity of the devices, at which point we probably will expect to see about one every 2 weeks. So we'll learn lots of stuff about the universe. Mergers of other objects, other heavy things that are rotating around each other will be seen. Maybe we'll discover dark matter. Maybe there will be cosmological gravitational waves that we'll be able to pick up. But most of all, we don't know what we don't know. This is a new tool which gives us a whole new window into the universe. And really, God has created an amazing universe for us to explore. And gravitational waves are just now beginning to give us another handle on certain features of that world. So thank you very much.
Aren't you glad I roped Arnold into giving this presentation on gravitational waves? I knew he would do an outstanding job. I don't think I'm on. Am I on now?
Yes.
Well,
so Steve's trying to say that it's question period.
Yes, we have time for a couple of questions.
Francis, I saw your hand first.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the choice of those two locations and why those were chosen.
I actually don't know the reasons behind those two choices. Sorry, but why were those two choices, those two locations chosen? I'm not really sure. Maybe somebody here knows.
Politics.
Yes.
Politics.
Politics. Okay.
Hanford
is a site where there are lots of scientists already. Probably geological, you know, we've got to have a stable place far enough away from ocean tides, I think, to affect results and things like that as well.
Louisiana?
Well, I mean, maybe not big ocean waves or tsunamis, I don't know.
Next question here.
Yes.
What piqued my interest most about this result was the fact that it was described as a way of imaging the cosmos. And that seemed like a stretch to me.
Stretch, literally, like there was a string. Okay.
Partly because you need big events, and how many big events are there? Well, in the whole universe, there are probably quite a few. But I'm trying to understand how this imaging would occur at all. But I think from the description of the experiment that they determined the azimuth partly by the arrival time delay on the two. So that gives you one thing, but you need to know the distance. So they would have to deduce the distance probably from the shape of the excitation. In using Einstein's general relativity.
Right, so shall I comment on, I'll repeat the question, I think. So the observation is not viewing something, and how do we know the distances and the sizes and so forth? So yes, the angle, the approximate location of the sky is determined by the time delay, and the distances and the masses that we're talking about, the before and after masses, those were from comparing with predictions from numerical relativity calculations by people like Jones and Trella. So the distances, as I had on the screen, 1.3 billion light years, where is that number? Here it is, 1.3 billion light years away. That number is obtained from comparison with numerical relativity.
Okay, one more quick question.
One more quick question.
Apparently there was an increase in the ability of the instrument during those 5 years. Because there were several years where you detected nothing. Can you comment on what they did that made it better, or was it just a matter of statistics and luck that they got something?
Okay, so, yeah, during the 5 years of renovations, they improved the technology significantly. I can't speak about all the details, but better ways of detecting light, better ways of comparing the signal to noise, better ways of having stable mirrors. And the idea is that the next generation will be even much more sensitive, and the increase in the number of observed events is largely going to come not because the events are occurring more often, but because we'll see out further into a greater range of the universe where these events are seen to be occurring on a regular basis.
Okay, let's thank our speaker once again.